All right, welcome to the deep dive you need to get caught up on the frenetic pace of federal activity. This is the Federal News Update for Thursday, December 4th, 2025. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
Our mission today is, well, it's straightforward, but it is immense. We are performing a really comprehensive deep dive on just the dizzying array of activity that has unfolded.
And this is across all three branches, executive, legislative, judicial.
Exactly. All of it since just the start of December 3rd. And I have to say, this wasn't just, you know, a busy day in Washington. This felt like a watershed moment.
You really did.
We saw core policies, doctrines either rolled out or completely overturned. So we're not just going to report the actions. We're going to explore their immediate operational impact and what the long-term implications are for you, for the economy, and for the global stage.
You called it a watershed moment, and that's precisely the right word for it. I mean, if you just step back and look across the entire federal government, what you're seeing is this aggressive reassertion of executive authority, and it's coupled with a very, very coordinated deregulatory push from Congress. This administration is moving fast, and they're often bypassing the established norms, you know, the bureaucratic friction.
Which, as we're about to see, has created some immediate and pretty intense internal controversies.
Oh, absolutely. Especially inside the military command structure and with the civil service.
Okay, so let's start right there in the executive branch. Let's focus on defense and what the administration is now calling the doctrine of strength. I think the most visible sign of this, the most symbolic, is a huge change to the nation's defense apparatus.
A huge change, yeah. It signals a full pivot in global strategy.
You're talking about the name.
I'm talking about the name. While the statutory name, you know, on the books is still the Department of Defense, an executive order 14347 signed back in September has now formally authorized the use of Department of War.
And that's the primary name for all official communications now.
All of them. And it was fully operationalized across all the major announcements we saw on December 3rd.
But this is more than just rebranding a letterhead, isn't it? I mean, what does changing the label from defense back to war actually signal? Especially since the DoD name was adopted after World War II to reflect a totally different strategy.
Right, a post-war containment-focused strategy. This signals a profound functional and, I would say, philosophical shift. It's a deliberate return to a pre-1947 warfighting ethos.
So less reactive.
Much less. The official posture is moving away from purely reactive defense, from containment, and toward what the War Department now explicitly calls offensive deterrence.
Offensive deterrence.
Which means the U.S. is no longer going to rely solely on responding after an attack. Instead, it's adopting a more preemptive, more decisive stance. The priority is lethality and rapid, decisive action anywhere in the world. The message to allies and adversaries is crystal clear. The focus is on winning conflicts through aggressive means, not just, you know, managing international stability through passive defense.
And we saw that aggressive, offensive idea put into action immediately on December 3rd. U.S. Central Command, CNTCOM, announced the formal activation of a new doctrine, Task Force Scorpion Strike.
Or TFSS. And this task force, it marks a critical evolution in U.S. military doctrine. It's a recognition of the changing realities of modern conflict. For decades, U.S. defense was built around these high-cost, limited platforms.
Right, you're thinking of the F-35 fighter jet, which cost multi-millions, or the really sophisticated Reaper drones.
Exactly. TFSS pivots away from that, toward what they are calling a tritable mass.
Okay, a tritable mass. That's some serious technical language. Can you break that down for us? What does that actually mean on the ground?
It means low-cost, disposable, swarming assets. So essentially, you're sacrificing quality for quantity when you need to, instead of launching a $1 million missile at a $20,000 target.
Which has been a huge problem.
A massive economic problem. Now you use a cheaper, equally effective platform. This is a direct operational admission that U.S. adversaries have found the economic chink in our technological armor.
And the core asset that this new task force is fielding is the Low-Cost Unmanned Combat Attack System, or LUCS. And this is where the policy decision gets incredibly interesting, maybe controversial. Defense officials are explicitly acknowledging that the LUCS drone is a reverse-engineered clone of the Iranian Shahid 136.
The notorious kamikaze drone that's been so devastatingly effective in other conflicts.
That's right. So we're just copying it.
The term they're using is capability mirroring. And the strategic rationale behind this is, frankly, brilliant in its cynicism. You're turning the adversary's economic advantage against them. The Iranian Shahed 136 is so destructive precisely because it's cheap.
It's estimated, what, between $20,000 and $50,000?
Somewhere in that range, yeah. And these cheap drones can just saturate and overwhelm expensive multi-million-dollar air defense systems like a Patriot battery, which was designed to shoot down cruise missiles, not swarms of disposable drones.
So the U.S. is adopting the strategy of competing in the domain of cheap war. But some critics immediately pointed out, doesn't this signal a failure of U.S. innovation? I mean, are we really leading here, or are we just playing catch-up in a domain we used to dismiss as perimeter?
And that is the central strategic debate. From the War Department's perspective, this is just pragmatic adaptation. The U.S. version, the LUCAS, is estimated to cost around $35,000, which allows the U.S. to achieve these kinetic effects at a fraction of the cost of traditional missiles. The LUCS has the same delta wing design, it flies autonomously, and it has a multi-mode launch system catapult, rocket assist, or from a truck.
So it's very flexible.
Extremely flexible. It gives U.S. Special Operations Forces a deep strike capability without needing a massive logistical tail. It saves money, and it minimizes the risk to our high-value platforms. But, and this is a huge but, it also accelerates the global proliferation of autonomous weapons systems. It sets a very dangerous precedent.
This whole aggressive shift in posture led by the War Department has immediately created some internal friction, which brings us to the controversies swirling around Secretary Hegseth. Details from a DOD Inspector General report just surfaced on December 3rd.
Yeah, and the primary finding concerns what's now being called the Signal App controversy. The IG report found that Secretary Hegseth used the encrypted commercial messaging app, Signal, on his personal unclassified phone to coordinate highly sensitive military strikes against Houthi militants in Yemen.
On his personal phone. And who else was in this Signal group? That raises some serious questions about the chain of command.
It reportedly included National Security Advisor Mike Waltz and CIA Director John Ratcliffe. I mean, this is a major procedural violation. The justification they gave was speed and urgency. Using a commercial app lets you bypass the traditional secure system, SIPRNet.
Okay, we need to unpack SIPRNet for a second. That's a core piece of government jargon. Why is bypassing it such a big deal beyond just, you know, breaking the rules?
SIPRNet, the Secret Internet Protocol Router Network, is the U.S. military's secure, classified network. It's designed for information up to the secret level. It requires specific, secure hardware. It's inherently cumbersome compared to just, you know, opening an app on your smartphone.
So it's faster, but at what cost?
Exactly. While using Signal speeds up decision-making in a crisis, the IG concluded it violated DOD policy on several grounds. First, using a personal device for classified communication. Second, failing to properly record and archive executive strike orders. And third, and this is the critical one, it increases the risk of foreign intelligence exploitation.
Right. If a sophisticated adversary intercepts that communication.
And then classified information, we're talking secret, not releasable to foreign nationals, could have been exposed. That could compromise operational security and directly endanger U.S. troops on the ground.
The White House has issued statements supporting Hegseth's authority to declassify information, but the IG noted the procedure was violated regardless. And that whole administrative fight, it really pales in comparison to the kill everybody allegation.
It does.
This is related to the September 2nd Caribbean interdiction operation. And this is genuinely dark stuff.
It is. The legal and ethical implications are just staggering. The IG was investigating a verbal order Hegseth allegedly gave after a drug smuggling boat was initially disabled. And now you have lawmakers, including Republican Senator Rand Paul and Democrat Senator Gary Peters, demanding formal, open investigations. They're calling it a potential war crime.
And what's the specific action being investigated as a potential war crime?
The allegation is that a second strike was launched against unarmed survivors who were clinging to the wreckage in the water.
Wow.
Senator Peters highlighted that if those facts are true striking non-combatants who pose no imminent threat, it's a clear violation of the Uniform Code of Military Justice and international law. The key question here is one of jurisdiction. Was this a Title 10 military action where rules of engagement apply, or a Title 18 law enforcement operation where such an act could be defined as murder?
The legal gravity is completely different.
It shifts dramatically based on that classification.
So what has the administration's response been to these incredibly grave allegations?
The White House issued a statement of total exoneration. They're supporting Hegseth's fog of war justification. The idea that in the chaos of battle, you know, these sorts of decisions are understandable. But the critics, including those senators, are demanding the immediate release of the videotape of that second strike,
which the War Department has so far refused to provide.
Refused. It just underscores this administration's clear priority: decisive, aggressive action, even if it comes at the cost of intense political and legal scrutiny.
And speaking of scrutiny, the War Department has taken a very modern but also very controversial approach to managing information and controlling the narrative around all this.
Oh, yeah. They've completely restructured how they engage with the media. They're effectively trying to bypass the traditional press ecosystem entirely. On December 3rd, the department hosted an onboarding event for what they're calling a new Pentagon press corps.
And this new corps included over 70 independent journalists, podcasters, and social media influencers.
70 plus, yeah.
So what's the strategic goal of cultivating this this highly specific group of non-traditional media figures?
The objective is really twofold. First, they want to bypass what the administration sees as legacy outlets that are, in their view, inherently hostile to their goals. This creates a direct line of communication to their political base. And second, it's about strategic messaging. By using influencers, the department can push their narratives out very rapidly through channels that their target audiences already trust.
But the risk there seems huge.
The risk is the substitution of vetted independent journalism, which traditionally provides a necessary check on power with narratives driven by influencers. It really blurs the lines between objective information and strategic government propaganda.
Okay, that is an exhaustive look at the War Department's aggressive news stance. Let's pivot now to the executive branch's domestic policy agenda, because we're seeing massive regulatory rollbacks that affect everything from the car you drive to immigration. This is where the administration is using its power to directly change the American consumer landscape.
And the centerpiece of this domestic push is what President Trump and DOT Secretary Sean P. Duffy unveiled on December 3rd. It's called the Freedom Means Affordable Cars Initiative, and it's a sweeping rollback of the corporate average fuel economy, or CAFE, standards.
This is the complete repudiation of the last administration's climate and technology goals.
Complete.
Okay, let's get into the weeds on this. The actual numbers. What are the new targets? I mean, how big of a change are we really talking about here?
Oh, it's a massive change. We're talking about rolling the fleet-wide average back to, I think it's 34.5 miles per gallon by model year 2031.
34.5. And the old target was, what, over 50?
Over 50, yeah. Which, I mean, let's be honest, that was basically a mandate for electric vehicles. You just can't get to 50 mpg with the standard gas engine, not realistically across a whole fleet. This new lower standard explicitly favors the continued production of gasoline-powered vehicles.
And there's a really critical technical piece to this, aimed squarely at disrupting the EV market: the elimination of the CARIFE credit trading program. We have to spend some time here, because this is a major financial mechanism that's being dismantled.
This is absolutely crucial for understanding the immediate economic fallout. Historically, automakers like Ford or GM, who couldn't meet those stringent fuel economy standards, usually because they sell a lot of big trucks and SUVs, could just buy regulatory credits from pure EV manufacturers.
Like Tesla.
Exactly, like Tesla, who easily exceed those standards.
So Tesla was essentially selling its excess regulatory compliance.
Precisely. And this system, it functioned as a major high-margin revenue stream for them. It was a massive cross-subsidy for EV startups. Removing this mechanism strips those pure EV companies of a significant guaranteed cash flow. At the same time, it allows the legacy automakers to keep producing their popular high-margin gas vehicles without paying penalties or having to pay their EV competitors.
So it's a huge economic boost for Detroit and a massive hit for Silicon Valley.
That's a perfect summary.
And despite the obvious environmental implications, the administration is framing this whole rollback purely around inflation, affordability, and safety for you, the consumer.
That is the narrative, yes. They're projecting the rule will save the U.S. economy about $109 billion and reduce the average vehicle price by $1,000. They're calling it a necessary anti-inflationary measure.
And they have a safety argument, too.
They do. The Department of Transportation is claiming that by lowering new car prices, consumers will be encouraged to replace their older, potentially unsafe cars sooner. Their analysis says this could save 1,500 lives and prevent 250,000 serious injuries by 2050.
It's a complex economic and safety argument pitched against those environmental concerns. But this move has triggered an immediate and pretty significant legal fight.
Oh, within hours of the announcement, the Center for Biological Diversity and the state of California announced lawsuits. This is setting up a profound legal showdown.
Because California has that unique authority under the Clean Air Act waiver.
Exactly. They can set their own stricter emissions rules, which they have, and those rules currently mandate a path toward EV adoption. This rollback is a direct challenge to that authority. It means the Supreme Court may ultimately be the one to decide whether federal policy or California's environmental mandate controls the nation's automotive future.
All right, moving from cars to borders. The Department of Homeland Security announced a highly restrictive new policy on December 3rd. A pause on all immigration applications from 19 high-risk countries. This is an immediate crackdown.
And the list of countries is sweeping. It includes Venezuela, Haiti, Iran, Afghanistan, and numerous others across Africa and the Middle East. The official justification they cited was a recent high-profile incident where two National Guard members were shot by an Afghan national. That triggered a security review that they say found significant vetting failures.
So how is this pause actually being operationalized? Because it sounds like this functions as a de facto ban on legal immigration from these places.
That is the consensus view. And the mechanism is deliberately slow and cumbersome. The pause applies to all individuals born in or holding citizenship from these nations. It doesn't matter where they currently live or what kind of application it is.
Okay.
And DHS has mandated a thorough re-review process. This involves mandatory in-person interviews and file re-adjudication, even for applications that were already cleared. So by requiring this new intensive process for every single application, they are guaranteed to create a massive backlog that could stretch on for years.
So it achieves a multi-year ban using national security authorities.
Without ever calling it a ban.
And this action coincided with some very high-profile enforcement surges across the country, right? Focusing on specific communities.
Yes, we saw two major operations detailed. First, there was Operation Catahoula Crunch, launched in New Orleans. It specifically targets criminal offenders, rapists, gang members, pedophiles who were released from local custody because of sanctuary city policies.
So they're capitalizing on that political conflict with local governments.
Explicitly. DHS officials stressed they are targeting the worst of the worst who were released back onto the streets. And then you have the highly visible enforcement actions up in Minneapolis.
Which are tied to the Somali immigrant community and a massive fraud investigation.
Exactly. Federal enforcement is heavily targeting that community following the investigation into the billion-dollar COVID fraud scheme. And the rhetoric that's accompanied this has been extremely pointed.
Which prompted a very swift and equally strong reaction from congressional Democrats.
It did. Representative Ilhan Omar, who represents that district, she responded directly. She said, "Your message of bigotry won't work. Somali Americans are here to stay." And then you had other Democrats, like Senator Dick Durbin and Representative Pramila Jayapal, immediately challenging the whole focus of these operations.
What was their argument?
They're arguing that ICE's own numbers show that the vast majority, 73% of those detained nationally, have no criminal record at all. Jayapal cited data from a recent Chicago raid where only about 2.5% had any criminal history. Their point is that this is primarily civil immigration enforcement, not some focused criminal cleanup.
And to round out this aggressive executive branch agenda, the administration is also using federal funding as direct leverage against state governments, specifically targeting SNAP, the food stamp program.
Yeah, this is a major escalation. USDA Secretary Brooke Rollins announced that the administration will stop moving federal SNAP funds to 22 Democratic states and Washington, D.C. starting next week.
Just cutting off the funding. What is the core dispute here that's led to withholding essential food money?
The USDA is demanding that these states share sensitive, personally identifiable data names, immigration status of SNAP recipients. They claim they need this information to root out widespread fraud.
And the states are refusing.
The states have sued the federal government. They argue the request is illegal, it violates privacy, and that the information would primarily be used to facilitate the administration's immigration crackdown. They say it would put vulnerable people at risk and have a chilling effect on people participating in a vital program. So this move, it creates immediate and immense fiscal pressure on these states.
It forces them to choose between complying with a federal mandate they believe is illegal or suddenly having to cover billions in food assistance costs all by themselves.
That's the choice.
Wow. Okay. That comprehensive set of actions, From the War Department's posture to the physical assault on democratic states, it really sets the stage for a dramatic conflict. Now let's shift our focus to the legislative branch. The House spent December 3rd in a highly coordinated deregulatory and America First offensive.
And that coordination with the executive branch is the key thing to watch. They passed a triad of bills aimed at reducing the regulatory state and decoupling the U.S. economy from Chinese influence.
Let's detail that first piece of legislation, the CLASS Act.
That's H.R. 1005, the Combating the Lies of Authoritarians in School Systems Act. It passed 242-176. And this bill is focused squarely on foreign soft power influence inside the U.S. educational system.
So what does it actually do?
It explicitly prohibits public K-12 schools from accepting funds or entering into contracts with the Chinese government or the Chinese Communist Party.
So this sounds like an effort to get things like the Confucius Institutes out of public schools. It's moving the great power competition directly into American classrooms.
That's exactly what it is. The legislative goal is to ensure U.S. students aren't subjected to CCP-influenced curriculum, decoupling a key cultural vector from foreign soft power influence. It's part of a much broader and, frankly, bipartisan concern about these kinds of influence operations.
Okay, next up, let's look at how the House is trying to institutionalize a permanent anti-regulatory feedback loop.
They're doing that through the DUMP Red Tape Act, H.R. 4305. It passed 269-146. This bill is technically simple, but it is strategically massive. It codifies a red tape hotline within the Small Business Administration. Yeah, it requires the SBA to maintain a direct statutory channel for businesses to report regulations they find burdensome, costly, or confusing.
So by creating this mandatory feedback channel, they're generating quantifiable data.
They are. The goal is to provide a permanent official data stream that future administrations and Congress can then use to justify regulatory repeal campaigns. It moves regulatory reduction from just a political goal to a data-driven process. It sets up a permanent system for dismantling the administrative state piece by piece.
And the final piece of this triad, it actually freezes the growth of the regulatory state itself.
For small businesses, yes. That's the Small Business Regulatory Reduction Act, H.R. 2965. It passed 223-190. And this act imposes a zero-growth regulatory budget on the SBA.
Zero growth. What does that mean in practice?
It means that for every dollar of new regulatory cost the agency imposes on small businesses, an equivalent dollar of existing regulatory cost has to be identified and repealed. It effectively freezes the regulatory state for small businesses at its current size.
And in the context of the federal workforce, all of these bills brought up that recurring debate over federal union official time.
Oh, yes. Republicans use the debate to criticize the use of official time. They argue it removes union reps from their primary jobs and that there's a lack of financial reporting on how that taxpayer money is spent on union activities. Democrats immediately fired back, calling the whole legislative push a targeted attack on union rights.
Right. They argue that official time is essential for things like workplace safety and discrimination cases.
Exactly. And merit system appeals. They say it ultimately supports federal employee integrity. And this friction is just magnified by the fact that agencies like the EPA have already started canceling their collective bargaining agreements unilaterally.
Okay, let's move over to the Senate. Their focus was decisively on energy dominance and reshaping the federal judiciary.
The Senate took a critical procedural step on December 3rd. There was a narrow 49-47 vote to agree to the motion to proceed to SJ Raise 91. And the narrowness of that vote really reflects the deep environmental division in the chamber.
And SJ Raise 91 is a Congressional Review Act resolution, a CRA, which is a powerful tool. What is it targeting?
The CRA is specifically designed to overturn rules from a previous administration. This resolution targets a Biden-era rule that had restricted oil and gas leasing in the coastal plain of the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge.
In ANWR.
In ANWR, yeah. This narrow vote paves the way for final passage, which would mandate the reopening of ANWR to drilling. This is a central pillar of the current administration's energy dominance strategy.
Meant to increase global oil supply and reduce dependence on foreign sources.
And diminish the geopolitical leverage held by oil-producing adversaries. That's the goal.
And meanwhile, the Senate is just relentlessly moving to reshape the federal bench.
The confirmation process continued with smooth efficiency. Matthew E. Orso was confirmed as a U.S. District Judge for the Western District of North Carolina.
And that was a significant vote, 57-41.
A very strong bipartisan margin. And on top of that, cloture was invoked on the nomination of Susan Courtright Rodriguez, 63-34. That sets her up for final confirmation. These robust margins signal continued success in placing conservative judges on the federal bench, often with enough Democratic support to get past any procedural hurdles.
Which solidifies the long-term judicial influence of the administration.
For decades to come.
Now we have to address something that affects millions of Americans directly. This is a truly impending crisis. The Affordable Care Act subsidies. The clock is ticking down to zero here.
The deadline is critically close. The enhanced ACA premium subsidies, the ones put in place during the pandemic to make coverage affordable, they are set to expire at the end of December.
And this is not a theoretical problem. This is a genuine crisis for about 24 million Americans who rely on those subsidies.
They are facing massive premium hikes. The estimates are between 24% and 50% right as the new year begins. This is an immediate, catastrophic affordability concern for millions of families.
So what's the political impasse? Why can't they just do a straightforward extension?
Well, Senate Republicans lack a unified alternative proposal. Senator Bill Cassidy has been circulating his HSA conversion plan, but it hasn't been finalized or, universally accepted by the GOP.
Okay, let's define that HSA conversion plan for people because that jargon can be confusing. What does that actually mean for the average person?
Right now, the enhanced subsidies come as immediate tax credits. They're paid monthly, they reduce your premium costs right away. Cassidy's plan would convert those premium tax credits into contributions to health savings accounts, or HSAs.
Which are long-term tax advantage savings accounts.
Right, but they require you to have a high-deductible health plan. So critics say this forces people into plans with high out-of-pocket costs. You're trading immediate, predictable relief for long-term savings, which doesn't help you if you need to see a doctor today and can't afford the deductible.
Meanwhile, Democrats are just pushing for a simple extension.
Correct. Senate Democratic Leader Chuck Schumer and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, they're pushing hard for a clean 3-year extension. But they know Speaker Johnson might block the vote in the House.
So they're discussing a discharge petition.
They are. It's a rarely used procedural move that forces a bill to the floor for a vote if a majority of the House signs the petition. That would require, I think, 4 Republican signatures, which is a huge political ask, but the urgency is so high it might just be achievable.
As Senator Hawley noted, this is a crisis. Premiums are already surging dramatically. If this extension fails, millions of families will have to choose between massive debt, dropping their coverage, or just taking on these debilitating expenses in January.
It's an immediate, high-stakes political vulnerability for the GOP, especially ahead of the midterms. Millions of those affected are in red states. Failure to act will have immediate, painful, and quantifiable financial consequences for their own constituents.
Okay, finally, let's discuss one of the most unusual political maneuvers of the week. President Trump's full and unconditional pardon of a sitting Democratic Congressman, Henry Kohler of Texas, and his wife.
This is truly extraordinary political maneuvering. It cuts right across party lines. Kohler and his wife were indicted last year on conspiracy and bribery charges. They were accused of accepting nearly $600,000 in payments from foreign entities, including the government of Azerbaijan and a Mexican bank.
So normally, a sitting congressman from the opposing party would be the last person to get this kind of clemency.
The last person. But the political calculation here is fascinating. Kohler is a moderate Democrat, and he's known for frequently and very publicly criticizing the previous administration's border policies.
And Trump explicitly framed the pardon around that. He claimed Kohler was unfairly targeted for speaking the truth about the border.
Right. And the implications here are multi-layered. One, the pardon immediately stabilizes a key swing district in South Texas. It makes it harder for Republicans to recruit a strong challenger against him. Two, the move was welcomed by House Democratic leadership like Hakeem Jeffries, which complicates the Republican effort to portray Democrats as divided.
And three.
And three, it signals the president's willingness to use his clemency power to reward political allies, regardless of their party, if they align with his core policy goals, especially on immigration.
That is a deep dive into the political and policy maneuvers across the two political branches. Let's now shift our focus to the federal workforce, their financial health after the shutdown, the future role of AI in government. These are critical concerns for the people working inside the system.
And we've seen some resolution on pay raises, but the underlying morale issues are still there. Tens of thousands of blue-collar Defense Department employees under the federal wage system, they're finally slated to receive their long-delayed 2024 pay raises.
A year-long delay is immense. Why did it take so long for these specific employees to get paid?
The raises were stalled for nearly a year because of, well, institutional chaos. Back in April, Defense Secretary Hegseth initiated a purge of several advisory committees, and that unintentionally halted the DoD wage committee's ability to meet and authorize the new regional wage schedules.
And their only function is to approve those schedules.
Their only function. So the raises were just paused until the committee was reconstituted and able to meet last week. The good news is the raises are retroactive and should be in their next paychecks. But the delay, it really highlights the severe institutional disruption that these executive actions can cause.
And the impact of that long government shutdown earlier this year is still heavily affecting the workforce's financial stability and their mental health. It makes that pay delay even more painful.
Oh, morale is reported as non-existent across many agencies. Employees were forced to dip into their thrift savings plan, their TSP, their emergency savings. They experienced constant dread and worry. Many took on significant credit card debt just to cover basic necessities.
And it underscores the critical need for financial preparation, especially since the current continuing resolution only funds the government through January 30th.
Meaning another shutdown threat is just weeks away.
This brings us to financial guidance, specifically for the Thrift Savings Plan, the federal retirement program. The emotional impact of this instability can lead to some really poor financial decisions.
Absolutely. Certified financial planner Art Stein warns that stress and emotion, especially after a shutdown, often lead to costly investment mistakes that can severely damage your retirement. The classic error is moving all your money to the G fund, the government bond, cash account, after the market has already dropped.
So you're selling low and locking in your losses.
Exactly. And then you fail to get back into the stock funds, the CS and I funds, in time to capture the inevitable recovery.
So the key advice is discipline over panic. How should Feds view market instability now, given all this recent trauma?
Well, the first step is clarity. You need to define what a stock market crash actually is. It's a 20% or more drop from a previous high. It's a bear market. This is an inevitable event. It happens on average every 4 to 7 years. The strongest recommendation is to define your appropriate long-term allocation.
Between stocks and bonds.
And then stick with it no matter what the headlines say. For younger employees, a market decline should be seen as a buying opportunity. You're just purchasing shares cheaper with every biweekly contribution.
And what's the crucial recommendation for Feds who are trying to rebuild their emergency savings with that January 30th deadline looming?
Stein strongly recommends reducing your TSP contributions, but only down to the 5% match level. It's critical not to go below that because you lose the full federal match, and then you aggressively use the freed up funds to rebuild your emergency savings.
But the goal being 3 to 6 months of expenses in cash.
Exactly. Given how short the current CR is, rebuilding that cash buffer is the single most important financial priority right now.
We're also seeing significant conflict over workforce rights and loyalty. The situation of the Environmental Protection Agency is a perfect example of this. It's leading to what some are calling a brain drain.
Yeah, 6 former EPA employees, part of a group of 17 who were terminated or suspended, have filed an appeal to the Merit Systems Protection Board, the MSPB. They're challenging their firings.
And these were the employees who signed that highly public declaration of dissent back in June.
That's right. They criticized the administration's policies and Administrator Lee Zeldin for recklessly undermining the agency's mission.
So what are their legal claims versus the EPA's justification for firing them?
The employees, they're alleging illegal retaliation for exercising their First Amendment rights and for their perceived political affiliation. They argue federal employees have the right to speak out on matters of public concern without fear of retribution. But the EPA argues that these employees undermine the mission, they lacked sound judgment, and that the agency isn't required to tolerate actions that interfere with its operations.
So they're framing it as an issue of performance and mission alignment, not political speech.
Correct. But the situation seems to be having a chilling effect on the broader civil service. People are hesitant to raise concerns or dissent.
And that's particularly true because this follows the EPA's cancellation of all its collective bargaining agreements back in August.
Exactly. The union argues that stripping away collective bargaining removed the employee's primary legal tool for fighting these actions. The union president described the firings as adding to a brain drain of talented experts who are choosing to leave the federal sector and creating a chilling effect on everyone who remains.
Okay, finally, let's look at the long-term future of the federal workforce through the lens of artificial intelligence. Dr. Ramaya Krishnan from Carnegie Mellon recently discussed the government's strategic plan for deploying generative AI.
And his core analysis, it provides a really critical framework for how governments should think about deploying this technology. It's about distinguishing between augmentation and automation based entirely on the cost of failure.
That's a great concept. So where is augmentation necessary?
Augmentation is needed for what he calls consequential tasks. Tasks where the cost of an error is high or where ethical requirements mandate human oversight. A perfect example is a 911 dispatch call. AI might process data faster, but the human must remain in the loop to make that final crucial decision.
The AI supports the human, it doesn't replace them.
Exactly. And conversely, full automation or triage is suitable for administrative tasks. Things like fielding routine questions about permits or forms or basic Q&A where the cost of an error is much lower. And AI is also seen as crucial for supporting citizen accessibility, offering multilingual support or assistance for citizens with different abilities.
And what's the recommended public policy for managing this inevitable disruption to millions of jobs?
Dr. Krishnan and his colleagues, they recommend a public policy response on the scale of what President Lincoln did during the Civil War in 1862. They're calling for a digital land grant initiative.
That's a fascinating historical parallel. You're referencing the Morrill Act. How does that model translate to the modern AI challenge?
Well, the original Morrill Act democratized access to agricultural technology by creating land-grant universities. It ensured that new skills were distributed across both rural and urban America. A digital land-grant initiative would similarly democratize access to AI education and the necessary skills for all citizens. It's a massive federal investment in education and skills training designed to harness the technology for broader prosperity and, crucially, to mitigate the inequality that will arise if only a select few have access to these skills.
That is a critical structural idea for managing the future. Okay, let's shift our focus now to the third co-equal branch of government, the judicial branch, and how it's interacting with executive power and all this state-federal friction.
The Supreme Court was busy on December 3rd. They heard oral arguments in Olivier v. City of Brandon, and this case has profound implications for civil liberties and the relationship between state and federal courts.
What's the core issue being debated in that case that could affect the average person?
The case centers on whether a citizen can file a federal civil rights lawsuit challenging a local statute after they've already been convicted under that statute in state court. Right now, a legal doctrine often prevents federal courts from interfering with state criminal proceedings.
Right.
A ruling for Olivier would significantly expand the ability of citizens to challenge unconstitutional laws in federal court. It would strengthen First Amendment protections against local government overreach. But a ruling for the city would reinforce the finality of state court judgments, potentially shielding local governments from federal scrutiny.
And the court is preparing for a major case next week that directly challenges the structure of the federal government itself. This is a key litmus test for the unitary executive theory.
It absolutely is. On December 8th, the court will hear Trump v. Slaughter. And this case directly challenges the constitutionality of independent agencies, like the Federal Trade Commission, and the protections that shield their commissioners from at-will removal by the president.
Can you explain the unitary executive theory and why independent agencies are the target?
Sure. The unitary executive theory basically says that the president must have unfettered control over the entire executive branch, including all agencies, because the Constitution vests all executive power in the president alone.
But independent agencies are structured to be insulated from that.
Exactly. Their commissioners serve for fixed terms and can only be removed for cause, like malfeasance. That gives them political insulation. If the court rules that the president can fire these commissioners at will, it would dismantle a crucial layer of regulatory independence. It would confirm the unitary executive theory and give the president direct, immediate control over vast swaths of the economy and federal regulation.
And in the meantime, the lower courts are illustrating this ongoing practical friction between state and federal authority.
Right. We have three recent actions that really detail this tension.
Okay. First, a conflict over religious liberty and public health.
Yeah.
In West Virginia, the state Supreme Court stayed a lower court ruling that had forced schools to accept religious vaccine exemptions. This is critical because it halts the expansion of religious liberty claims at the expense of public health authority, at least for now, pending a more thorough review.
Second, regarding immigration enforcement at the local level, which ties back to those DHS operations we discussed.
The Wisconsin Supreme Court agreed to hear a challenge on the legality of county sheriffs holding detainees for IC without a judicial warrant. This case will determine the boundaries of local law enforcement participation in federal immigration enforcement. If the court rules against the sheriffs, it would limit the ability of federal authorities to rely on local police to carry out their deportation agenda.
And finally, a very rare and significant judicial check on the president's personnel moves.
Yeah, the reverberations of the Third Circuit's ruling from earlier this week are still being felt. That court declared the temporary appointment of Alina Haba as U.S. Attorney for New Jersey unlawful.
And this is significant because the president used the Vacancies Reform Act to install her without Senate confirmation.
And the court ruled that he had exceeded the scope of that act. This decision serves as a significant, though rare, judicial check on the ability of the executive to install unconfirmed officials in key positions. It's a real limit on the unitary executive's ability to bypass the Senate.
We've covered a massive amount of activity across all three branches in an extremely short period. Let's try to synthesize all these actions now and define the new national identity that seems to be taking shape.
I think if you pull together all the threads, the 19-country immigration pause, the congressional efforts to decouple from China with the CLASS Act, the regulatory retreat from global climate agreements through the CAFE rollback, what emerges is a picture of the return of Fortress America.
A nation turning inward, prioritizing sovereignty, physical borders, and economic self-interest over multilateral global engagement.
Exactly. The administration is signaling a strategic withdrawal from globalization. They prefer transactional relationships over traditional alliances, and they're focusing on domestic economic and security goals above all else. The central risk here, though, is the erosion of U.S. soft power and the potential formation of a counterblock of nations who see the U.S. as only engaging on terms of strict dominance.
Potentially pushing them closer to rivals like China and Russia.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the economic fallout from just December 3rd, the administration's policy is clearly creating some identifiable winners and losers right now.
Oh, you can clearly define them. On the winner side, you have the legacy automakers. They're freed from costly EV mandates and buying credits. You have oil and gas producers benefiting immediately from the ANWR opening. And you have small businesses, which are the main beneficiaries of the regulatory freeze.
And the losers.
The losers are the pure play EV manufacturers who relied on that CAFE credit system for revenue. Renewable energy developers who face less favorable conditions. And crucially, high-skilled immigrants and international students from those 19 nations now subject to the application pause.
So the macro impact becomes a clear trade-off that, you know, you, the listener, have to calculate for yourself.
It's a short-term promise of growth and lower immediate consumer prices. That projected $1,000 car savings, cheaper gasoline, versus the long-term risk of U.S. industry falling behind globally in the development of next-generation green technology. We could be ceding technology leadership to our competitors.
Let's circle back briefly to the military doctrine, because the deployment of that LUCS drone system, the reverse-engineered Iranian munition, it feels like a true technological and strategic inflection point.
It absolutely is the normalization of asymmetric warfare. The U.S. is explicitly adopting the tactics of its adversaries. Cheap, disposable, autonomous mass warfare. This deployment signals the official end of the U.S. era of uncontested technological supremacy, where we thought we could dominate conflicts just with expensive high-end platforms.
But this stapod is deterrence in the short term.
It does, by making the U.S. competitive in the domain of cost, but it simultaneously accelerates the global proliferation of autonomous weapon systems, lowering the barrier to entry for lethal drone warfare worldwide.
And finally, just to summarize the overarching executive approach we've seen. This is the unitary executive in practice.
We have seen the theory systematically executed across multiple domains. Bypassing traditional media, reinterpreting environmental and regulatory laws, prioritizing speed over established procedure like secure communication, and pushing the boundaries of personnel appointments to limit the Senate's power. The outcome is a federal government that is highly responsive to the president's will, more agile in implementing policy, but also fundamentally prone to abrupt policy reversals and intense internal friction with a career bureaucracy.
Which is evidenced by those mass resignations and the near-zero morale we talked about earlier.
Exactly.
What a dense day across Washington. We've seen activity ranging from the rebranding of the Pentagon and new drone doctrines in the Middle East to regulatory rollbacks that will affect the price of your next car and the ACA crisis looming for 24 million insurance holders.
The pace and the scope of these changes are just staggering. They touch every aspect of American life and our global posture. But as we wrap up this deep dive, consider this final provocative thought that connects the speed of all these technological and strategic shifts. The NASA administrator nominee, Jared Isaacman, he justified the urgency of the new space race by stating that falling behind China on the moon could shift the balance of power here on Earth.
Right.
So given that the U.S. has just deployed a reverse-engineered drone against an adversary's model, adopting their capability for asymmetric warfare, does the race for mere technological parity in both defense and space signal a fundamental failure of U.S. innovation? Or is it a necessary pragmatic strategy to maintain global dominance in a world where cheap, disposable technology now trumps expensive superiority?
That is certainly a vital question to mull over as you navigate the news landscape. Thank you for joining us for this extensive deep dive into the federal news update. We encourage you to explore these pivotal topics further and assess the implications for yourself.